Welcome to Dominion Radio on CKDU 88.1. We bring you grassroots news from across the country, focusing on stories and voices silenced by the mainstream media. For more on the topics you hear about tonight, check out the Dominion newspaper at www.dominionpaper.ca.
We have a great show lined up for you tonight. An interview with Richard Vogel explores the implications of the Security and Prosperity Partnership on labor and migration. An abridged excerpt from the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty's documentary examines HCAP's special needs campaign and their demand for higher welfare rates in Nova Scotia. Finally, the fight by the Passamaquoddy people to keep a liquefied natural gas terminal off their land. But first, the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
The Security and Prosperity Partnership is a secretive agreement currently being negotiated by the governments of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Although billed by its proponents as an initiative to increase prosperity and enhance security between the three NAFTA countries, critics view the Security and Prosperity Partnership as no less than an assault upon workers' rights, the environment, and the very democracies of all three countries. A key component of the SPP framework is the so-called NAFTA Super Corridor, an interconnecting system of massive highways extending from Winnipeg to Mexico City. Richard Vogel is a Texas-based writer and activist. A regular correspondent with Monthly Review magazine, he has written extensively about the NAFTA corridor and its implications for the continent. His recent article on the subject, Sharing the Plunder of the South, appeared in Canadian Dimensions magazine.
I wonder if you can sort of outline the SPP as you understand it from stateside and kind of the main aspects of the whole Security and Prosperity Partnership framework.
Basically, the key to understanding the SPP is the fact that NAFTA hit working people so hard and damaged the United States so much that I don't think they're ever going to try to do that again. And it's really an extension of NAFTA, but it's being done by executive agreement because even the Congresses, the legislatures, you know, won't pass some of these issues because they got to face the people back home. And that's when they started doing this secretive stuff, and that's what the SPP is. You can't even get that much information on it because of public backlash. There would be such public backlash against it.
Now, again, in your article, you describe the so-called NAFTA super corridor, or as it's been dubbed in kind of more conservative circles, the so-called NAFTA superhighway, as kind of the backbone structure of the SPP process. Can you explain to me why this project and why infrastructure projects like this have such importance to the SPP?
Okay, the two things that I think are necessary to understand what's happening as far as the NAFTA corridors all the way into Canada and all the way into Mexico is the issues of globalization. And the two issues here are, number one, cheap offshore goods from the Far East, mostly consumer goods, but even some of the bigger stuff. And the other one is the labor migration thing. The NAFTA super corridors were actually started in Texas. I've had debates with local people that say they don't even exist, but you can actually go to Google Earth and see it because it's so big. And it's the infrastructure to carry the imported goods, the offshore goods from Canada, from China, because after the strike in 93 on the West Coast, they started routing container traffic from the Far East to the Pacific ports of Mexico. They land bridge them up through Laredo, then they're loaded on the Highway 35, which is the NAFTA corridor, and they go through Kansas City all the way to Omaha and Winnipeg that way. They split off at Kansas City. They're trying to put this new Interstate 69, which is going to be a NAFTA super corridor, which will go more towards the northeast in a more direct route up to Evanston, Illinois, and then straight towards the Atlantic coast. So cheap goods coming in that way. And the other thing is the migrants. We have, they say, 12 million migrants in the United States, and I don't know if you've been following the struggle to get a guest worker program. But they've been trying to pass that, and that would be the pipeline to move people up and down from Mexico and Central America and the Caribbean, as far as that goes, up to all the way to Canada, but especially to the heartland of the United States. So that's what the infrastructure is for. So the United States economy is, and the Canadian economy to a big extent, according to my studies, are dependent on, you know, cheap labor coming from Mexico and Central America and the Caribbean and, of course, Far East, and this flow of cheap goods that cannot be interrupted.
Another key aspect of the whole security prosperity partnership is the security aspect. I mean, there's 10 working groups, if I'm not mistaken, on that are focused on various aspects of trade and three that are exclusively focused on security. So I guess in talking about the need for cheap offshore goods and cheap labor, how does the whole security aspect tie into this?
I looked at the concentration of the Department of Homeland Security along the southern U.S. border, where most of it is. And it's concentrated down there, and they have not caught one terrorist or one terrorist suspect down there. And so, as far as I can see, security is a concern, but it's also a convenient cover for putting the SPP into full effect and getting a guest worker program going, too. I mean, they're just so linked together now. The war on terror now includes everything. And so I think it's a convenient cover, but the main issue is keeping the economy going. You know, I'd like to, you know, remind you that and listeners that the first thing that Giuliani and Bush said after 9/11 was, God, don't quit spending. Keep spending, you know, because the economy had to keep going. So the security is legitimate, but if you go back to border security in the United States, the Border Patrol originally was set up to keep Chinese workers from coming through Mexico into California after the Chinese Exclusion Act. You have to put this in some kind of a historical perspective, too.
Now, I guess the latest news from the U.S. Congress seems to indicate that there's significant opposition, bipartisan opposition, to the SPP process. I think it was last week an amendment was passed in the House of Representatives by, I think, a margin of 263 to 62, cutting all funding to transportation initiatives associated with the SPP. And obviously, the one that was mentioned in particular was the NAFTA Superhighway.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of grassroots resistance down here. The Texas legislature passed to accommodate the NAFTA corridor, the Trans-Texas corridor, which is the bottom link of the NAFTA corridors. That's all the corridors that run through Texas. And there was this exclusive development agreement set up. It's being constructed as a toll road that will be free of federal regulation, which has all sorts of implications. But also, they started seizing land, and they passed a quick take law, for example, that allows them to move in and to displace people off the land within 24 hours and move them off their land, unless they've got a, there was some catch in there about if they were had some kind of an original loan or something. So, number one, quick take in this issue of eminent domain has raised the ire of a lot of people. I did an article with some farmers in East Texas and ranchers in East Texas that have a surveyor watch, they call it. And they're carrying walkie-talkies, and they're waiting for the surveyors for this I-69 that's supposed to cut through the farmland in East Texas. And there's serious opposition down here. And there was opposition in the state legislature, and I think there's been some blowback in the federal legislature, too, because there's a group called CorridorWatch.org on the internet that it's an amazing website talking about all the connections here and the grassroots resistance, and it's a grassroots resistance organization to fight this. They've done wonderful work and they've tied up the Texas legislature, and I think that this is affecting the national legislature too. People say, we don't want this quick take, like you can be thrown off your land in 24 hours. Yeah, that's pretty un-American as far as people understand, you know, how eminent domain was supposed to be used. And of course, a year before last, the Supreme Court ruled on that, because the question was, has there ever been any question under United States law that eminent domain could be used to take over private lands that were needed for public development? The question that went up is, can they take over, can private lands be taken over for private development? Can the state do that? And of course, the Supreme Court, the conservative Supreme Court said, yes, they can do it. That's what that test case was about. So there's a lot of people saying, we don't want that. I mean, as far as I can see, I've heard, and I haven't been able to pin this down, that they were talking about a quick take law to run a highway, an Atlantica highway, to cut through Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if they could work this out where they could subvert the local laws, they could pass a quick take law, and because there would be a lot of resistance up there. I've been visiting up there, and they don't, you know, they don't want a 1,200 foot wide, you know, highway or whatever it would be up there, you know, running through the land, because it totally alters the landscape. I mean, Texas is being raped. It's just incredible.
Within the American conservative scene, there's a lot of, you know, from the same sectors that have really opposed immigration from the South American continent, you know, been vehemently opposed to immigration, has come this opposition to the SPP, and obviously Lou Dobbs, Jerome Corsi kind of subset. I mean, online, if you Googled SPP, you'd find a dozen kind of conservative websites.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about this kind of, it seems to me, conservative nationalist backlash against the SPP as well?
Well, in Texas, I mean, in the United States, I think that a lot of people don't know or don't pay attention to the fact that we've got two Republican parties. And one of them are the traditional conservative Republicans, and their power was basically in the manufacturing sector. And then you had the neocons, Republicans, and they are into finance, and that most of their power comes from finance and energy. And the neocons, that's why I said Texas is a neocon state, finance and energy, because it's never been strong on manufacturing. So the traditional conservatives, they're the people that originally were, you know, the National Association of Manufacturers and stuff like that, they could live with unions. I think they don't like what's happening to the United States. There's a big front about how the United States is going, but we're getting pretty shabby. Number one, traditional conservatives aren't that much into privatization. They actually believe that some things should be public, like the infrastructure, like the interstate highway system. They backed that 100% because it was good for what they were trying to do. They were concerned about their communities, and they didn't want to see this mass, and they don't want a guest worker program. They're anti-guest worker program also. They're concerned about their communities. The shrinking tax base, our public schools are terrible because the tax base for those has been, you know, reduced, and privatization has taken over even in public education. So they're more like the old traditional, you know, manufacturing base. The neocons, on the other hand, you know, want the NAFTA corridors. They want cheap offshore goods. They want the American people to be in debt. It's a good sign for them because finance, you know, the finance side is, that's what the American debt's all about. And so there's a lot of bad feelings. In fact, I think there's more bad feelings between the traditional conservative Republicans and the neocons. I mean, traditional conservative Republicans would say small government, no government, right? And the United States now has the biggest government that's ever existed and the biggest national debt that the world's ever seen. You know, Clinton had eradicated the national debt. So traditional conservatives are very frustrated, and they know that they were used by the neoconservatives and used and abused. And that's why we're not going to have a Republican president, you know. Not this next time. Of course, it won't make any difference because the Democrat we get's already bought and paid for. So Americans have to start looking elsewhere. But that's our struggles down here.
Okay, Richard, is there anything else you wanted to add?
we need to start bridging between countries. The globalization has got working people in each country so-called competing against working people in the other country, and I think working people need a look at these. We need to get a broader view of what our struggles are. Our struggles need to be global because we're going into global we're going into global contests on a local footing, and we're guaranteed to lose those because globalization has winners and losers. The losers are labor, most of us. The winners are finance, capital, and the big capitalists, and they are winning big time, and we need to understand that.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Vogel, a socialist writer and frequent contributor to Monthly Review magazine. Vogel is also the author of a recent article in Canadian Dimension magazine called Sharing the Plunder of the South, the NAFTA Corridors and Canada. To read more of Vogel's articles, visit www.monthlyreview.org. To learn more about the Security and Prosperity Partnership, visit www.integratethis.ca. This interview was recorded for CKDU Radio in Halifax. My name is Stuart Neatby.
Up to $150 per month is available under the special needs portion of Nova Scotia's welfare regulations. Many of those who receive welfare, however, are unaware of this program, which can provide them with critically needed funds for special dietary needs, transportation, eyeglasses, dental care, and child care. The Halifax Coalition Against Poverty, also known as HCAP, has launched a campaign to dismantle barriers to extra money for welfare recipients, based on the strong belief that people living on social assistance receive grossly inadequate incomes that won't protect their health or their dignity. Next up, we'll hear a short segment of HCAP and Praxis Media's one-hour documentary called Taking It Back.
Statistics Canada deems that a single person living on less than $17,895 per year is living in strained circumstances, having to spend a greater proportion of their income on food, clothing, and shelter. Welfare rates in Nova Scotia are roughly one quarter of that, at $5,600 per year. Living in this kind of poverty impacts every aspect of a person's life, including their health. The reality is that to live on welfare in Nova Scotia, as in the rest of the country, is to be condemned to a level of poverty that seriously compromises one's health. Health conditions and illness like diabetes, obesity, specific types of cancers, and poor maternal and prenatal outcomes are not only directly related to living in poverty, but are also exacerbated by it. Being poor means not only are you more likely to get sick, but that you are more likely to die from being sick. It is in this reality that the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty, in conjunction with the Dalhousie Legal Aid Society, local health care providers, and poor people in the Halifax area, have organized a special needs campaign. The immediate aim of the campaign is to force the Nova Scotia government to give poor people what they deserve. More money to cover basic health and living needs. The Halifax Coalition Against Poverty is an anti-poverty organization that fights the government for what poor people need. They are not funded by the government or part of the welfare system.
My name is Jill Ratcliffe, and I'm a member of the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty. I'm also coordinating the special needs clinics this summer. HCAP's demands, they include a doubling of welfare rates in Nova Scotia. We want poor communities to get what they need, including decent housing, a livable income, and access to healthy food and necessary medications. This is not possible considering the current welfare rates in Nova Scotia. And especially considering that those rates have been reduced by up to 36% in the past 18 years for single individuals. The current welfare allowance after rent for these individuals is merely $6 a day. People are just not able to meet their basic needs on these welfare rates. The Special Needs Campaign is a tool for people to organize and fight because those who hold wealth and power will not voluntarily give people what they need to live with dignity.
My name is Megan Leslie, and I'm a community legal worker at Dalhousie Legal Aid. And Dalhousie Legal Aid service is working sort of in concert with the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty on the Special Needs Campaign. I do anti-poverty work. I do representation of individuals on welfare matters, tenant rights matters, CPP disability, that kind of sort of legal area. But we also do quite a bit of community work here, looking at community and trying to see what the needs of the community are and looking at law to see how we can either use the law to help community or change the law to help community. The way it works here in Nova Scotia, welfare is broken down into sort of three categories. First category is shelter. Shelter amounts are, in my opinion, incredibly low and not realistic for any kind of shelter in Nova Scotia. But you do have a shelter amount. Then you do have this thing called a personal allowance. Personal allowance is all of your non-shelter expenses. So your clothes, your cup of coffee, your phone, your transportation, your haircuts, God forbid a gift for someone, but also food. It covers your food. And what it works out to, it's $200 a month, and that comes down to $6 a day. So really, you're living on $6 a day if your shelter amount covers your shelter. If it doesn't, then you're dipping into your $6 a day even to cover your shelter. So those are the first two categories, and that's supposed to be enough money for you to live. Those are supposed to meet your basic needs.
Current welfare legislation in Nova Scotia states that an allowance may be provided for certain items of special need to meet specific health and safety needs. Megan Leslie.
Special diets with community services. If you are on welfare, if you are on income assistance in Nova Scotia, you can get up to $150 above what you're already getting for shelter or for your personal allowance. So it's $150 extra bucks that you can get.
HCAP is currently working on a campaign to increase the money that people on welfare receive each month. The Special Needs Campaign involves establishing clinics where welfare recipients can work with healthcare professionals who can help them access the special needs provision in the current legislation. A similar special needs provision exists in the Ontario Social Services system. Anti-poverty groups from across that province followed the lead of the Toronto-based Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, or OCAP, who began organizing similar clinics.
My name's John Clark, and I'm an organizer with OCAP. What triggered it in the broadest sense was the fact that people living on social assistance receive grossly inadequate incomes that won't protect their health and their dignity. Back in about 2004, it emerged because we became aware of the fact that we were generally looking to advance the demand for the raising of the rates, and we were looking at the idea of ways in which we could actually, in practice right now, before we made progress on winning such a demand, actually get things that people were entitled to but were in practice being denied. And so we came up with this provision within the welfare regulations that enabled people to get the special diet. That was when the campaign was launched. We became aware of the fact that this existed, but of course it was an obscure provision. People didn't know about it. If they did apply, they were almost routinely turned down. But we thought, how about if an organized taking of that benefit were put into effect? If we, first of all, promoted knowledge of it, if we organized clinics where progressive nurses and doctors could actually diagnose people for the special diet. And then finally, when it was denied, people weren't functioning as individuals. There was a collective act of advocacy to ensure that people got what they were entitled to. And those were the elements of the special diet campaign. The truth is that when they first implemented the special diet provision, which I think goes back to the 1970s actually, they were envisaging a situation where some exceptional needs might be catered to. But even within the frame of reference of their own policies, The truth is that the erosion of welfare benefits in terms of spending power over the years has created a situation where if you're going to be on social assistance for a significant period of your life, you're going to automatically face health challenges because you're not going to be able to afford a diet that is adequate and that takes care of your health. So they've created a situation where the special diet becomes something that everyone needs when they're on social assistance in order to maintain basic health.
My name's Gary Block. I'm a family physician. I work with St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, as well as with Seton House Homeless Shelter and a group called Health Providers Against Poverty. And I was brought into the special diet campaign a few months after it started. I think health providers should be involved in this work because poverty is known to be an incredibly powerful risk for health problems. In fact, it may be one of the most powerful risks that we know. There's strong evidence for this. I mean, there's been huge amounts of research done on the connection between health and poverty and the risks to health caused by living in poverty. Traditionally, this is not a risk that health providers have addressed, and I think that's mostly because we haven't known how to address this. What the special diet campaign has given us is an actual tool as health providers to directly counteract the health effects of poverty. And I think that once health providers are prevented, first of all, with the evidence, and second of all, with something that they can do concretely to tackle poverty as a health issue, I think they absolutely have an ethical responsibility to jump in there and to tackle poverty as a health risk. We can first of all look at pretty big indicators of the effect of poverty on population health. So let's take, for instance, life expectancy. And this is something that's talked about quite often. It's been shown that people living in the poorest neighborhoods in Canada have a significantly lower life expectancy than people living in the highest income neighborhoods. And the numbers are quite striking. For a woman, it's in the order of 1.5 years shorter. For a man, it's in the order of 3 to 4 years shorter. And that's pretty powerful stuff. When you're looking at a population health level, that's an average. So there's some people who obviously live far shorter than that. And then that is just averaged out into this kind of number. If we look at rates of infant mortality, the rates are significantly higher when it comes to people living in the lowest income areas, to the order of 60% higher. Similar for rates of low birth weight, which is considered to be one of the best indicators of the health of a population. It's also between 40 and 60% higher in the lowest income areas. And these are Canadian statistics. If we look at chronic disease, I mean, the chance of someone living in poverty having diabetes, for instance, is about twice as high for a man and about 4 times as high for a woman. So pretty shocking statistics. Rates are similar for things like heart disease, for respiratory disease, for cancer, for liver disease. I mean, you name it. You pick a chronic disease, the rates are almost across the board significantly and shockingly higher amongst people living in poverty compared to the average Canadian population. One other area is child health. Also, shocking statistics when it comes to children. Hugely increased rates of poor school performance, of poor nutrition, of behavioral problems. All of these attributed to living in poverty. So the evidence is certainly there. Again, I mean, these are Canadian statistics. You can find this across the world. They've done studies on health and poverty, and the statistics are similar. There's really no question that the link is there and that it's been proven. The question is just what we're going to do about it now.
People in poor communities tend to think, you know, these are nice people. I sort of sympathize with them. I like their demands. But let's face it, you know, it's not really going anywhere. That's the sort of practical, I think, conclusion that people draw. But when you start to link those broader demands to practical struggles to win the things that can be won so that you can become stronger, so that you win bigger things. That's, I think, the real change that is pointed to by initiatives like the Special Diet Campaign. I think it teaches you that you've got to work daily in communities to fight for people's needs, and you can't just have this notion that you're going to advance abstract ideas floating around out there.
Jill Ratcliffe.
HCAP's long-term goals for these clinics are pretty multi-leveled, I would say. First of all, we see them as a way to really expand our organization and the capacity of our organization and meet the needs of people and communities that we don't necessarily meet in our day-to-day organizing. For example, the outreach for our clinics is happening at a lot of service providers and centers around the city that day-to-day sort of struggle with populations on welfare and meeting their needs, which are basically more money when it comes down to it. And so we're doing things like outreaching to parent and single parent resource centers and organizations that work with sex trade workers and organizations that work with people in addictions recovery and just sort of all of these service organizations and bringing our political messaging through this campaign to these organizations. Also, of course, like we're looking to take it beyond the clinics, and we understand that in order for these clinics to really be successful, or the call for sort of special needs money to be successful, people need to go beyond the clinics and actually take action. And whether that be going into the welfare offices where people are being denied special needs monies, or holding demonstrations out on the street where people are demanding change in social assistance policy and in all government policy relating to social assistance and social programs. Also, we want to move this clinic beyond the Halifax sort of municipality. We want to take it to rural areas of Nova Scotia where there are a real lack of services for people on welfare and a lack of knowledge about welfare rights, just hugely, hugely inadequate services. Another point for our long-term goal is to forward the anti-capitalist analysis of the organizations, so calling for broader social change beyond what can be gained from a doubling of income assistance rates. What I mean by HCAP forwarding an anti-capitalist agenda would be for that broader social change, and so creating a system where poor populations are no longer exploited for their cheap labor. So what we're looking for is a change in the way our society is organized. We understand that government supports the interests of the rich and powerful. We want that to change. We want to take back that power and give it back to the workers and the people who deserve it and whose hands it should be in. We're looking to do away with systems of poverty and all systems that perpetuate poverty, and so move towards a social system that would take care of its people and wouldn't condemn people to living in poverty because they are unable to work or have to work for a minimum wage job.
And then look at how that could be amplified, how we could build a movement that could ensure that, you know, people's housing was protected, that people's rights as workers were protected, how we could actually stop treating social mobilization as if it was some sort of cultural event or something, and actually present it as a very practical task that's got to be undertaken if we're not going to see people smashed.
I think that the slogan for this campaign is really take it back. I think it's take back the wealth and take back the power. Take it back.
Hey folks, in the interest of staying warm and keeping the heat on the asses of the Tories and the rich, we're going to take it back to the streets. So let's go, let's follow the banner.
When some of these people are starting to come on, they're not supposed to be there. I'm not sure the message is going to spread to everybody.
We're just listening to an abridged excerpt of the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty and Praxis Media's documentary on the special needs campaign in Nova Scotia.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the birds and bees. Now give me more.
Protest, Black Gold, Petropolitics. When it comes to the Alberta tar sands, we've all heard the catchphrases. If you're from Newfoundland or the Maritimes, you probably know someone who works there. If you live in Alberta, you probably hear about it being a major source of economic growth. If you're an environmentalist, you probably know that the tar sands are the biggest source of industrial greenhouse gases in Canada. The tar sands are setting global precedents in terms of how we deal with the decline in oil supply, indigenous rights to land, climate change, and labor rights. In November of 2007, the Dominion will publish a special issue on the Athabasca tar sands and their implications for Canada and the planet. The mainstream media isn't telling you what you need to know about the world's first gigaproject. For more information on the tar sands issue and how you can get involved with tar sands discussions from coast to coast, visit www.dominionpaper.ca/tarsands.
We Take Care of Our Land is a group of Passamaquoddy people organized to stop the current efforts to locate a liquefied natural gas terminal on Passamaquoddy land and in the ancestral waters of Passamaquoddy and Fundy Bays. Split Rock is the proposed location for the facility, an area of major historical, cultural, and spiritual importance to the Passamaquoddy people. The LNG terminal would prevent tribal members from their traditional access to ancestral waters. It would also present a broad range of environmental impacts to this ecologically rich and pristine part of the main coastline. Pierre Loisel spoke with David Moses Bridges, traditional artist, birch bark canoe maker, educator, community activist, and co-founder of We Take Care of Our Land.
We Take Care of Our Land is a group of Passamaquoddy people organized to stop the current efforts to locate an LNG terminal on Passamaquoddy land and in the ancestral waters of Passamaquoddy and Fundy Bays. They are part of the Three Nation Alliance to protect the Cody region, along with Save Passamaquoddy Bay Canada and Save Passamaquoddy Bay USA. We are currently joined on the telephone by David Moses Bridges, member of We Take Care of Our Land. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you.
I guess, for starters, could you tell us a little bit about the Passamaquoddy Nation for those who might not be familiar with who you are?
Well, Passamaquoddy Nation is the original inhabitants of Passamaquoddy Bay and the Passamaquoddy region. We've been here for thousands of generations. This is our homeland. We love this land. This land has always provided for us. It's a beautiful place. It's a pristine area on the coast of Maine and Canada, and it's very important for us to maintain that land for future generations, to maintain that land and the waters as well for future generations. It's provided for us, it continues to provide for us, and it will continue to provide in the future if we take care of it now, if we're good stewards of the land.
I was wondering if you could describe the relationship between the Passamaquoddy Nation and both the American and the Canadian governments, respectively.
The Passamaquoddy Nation, in regards to U.S. policy, the Passamaquoddy tribe for years what's called a state tribe, which means it didn't fall under federal jurisdiction. And all that changed in the early 70s when the Passamaquoddy tribe was granted federal recognition by the United States. On the Canadian side, there is no recognition currently, although historically we have had a presence over there. My great-grandfather was born on the Canadian side. Obviously, the U.S.-Canadian border goes right through the heart of our original territory and has divided our original ancestral homeland into two separate countries. We still have family on either side of the border. We still maintain the right to travel freely across that border as we're only traveling in our own homeland.
In 2005, the Passamaquoddy Tribal Council approved a lease to Quoddy LLC, which is an Oklahoma-based company, and they are proposing to build an LNG terminal at Split Rock. I was wondering if you could explain how the lease for the LNG terminal came to be dubiously passed by the Passamaquoddy Tribal Council and subsequently the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Well, the way it all began was it was announced that there was going to be a feasibility study. Most tribal members found out about this through the newspapers rather than from their elected leaders. Most of the information, in fact, all of the information prior to the vote in 2004 was handled by the developer. And this is the community vote that I'm referring to. Information was provided by the state of Maine and the developer with many, many promises, most of which I found dubious at best. They were proposing free gas for everybody, $1,000 a year in per capita distribution should this facility be built. So it was attractive to many community members because of that. When it came to be passed by the tribal council, the lease agreement itself was not shared with tribal people, and it wasn't even shared with many tribal councilors. And admittedly, on the part of some of the tribal councilors who did approve it, they didn't even read the lease prior to signing it. It's a 96-page lease, very, very detailed, and I would think that it would be important as elected leaders of the community to know and understand the lease and to also seek out third-party help in deciphering the lease. In other words, having somebody review the lease who was not associated with the developer.
On your website, you talk about the issue of descendants' rights. Can you explain what the issue of voting on descendants' rights is, particularly in the context of the LNG development?
Yeah, well, descendants' rights is just what it says, really. It's up to us, those living at present, to protect our homeland for future generations. It's very important that we do this because this is what our elders did for this. Many of them struggled for years and years, you know, to maintain our homeland and to maintain our culture. And it's up to us now to think about these things, to think about the future of our nation as we move forward. The duty that we have here now is to make sure that our children have a home and that they have a safe and secure homeland that they have free access to. This is very important to us as a group because it's coming from our hearts and it's speaking to the future of our nation.
With that said, can you describe what the proposed LNG site and nautical traffic would actually entail?
Yeah, well, the proposed site is right in the heart of the community. It's a very small community. It's about 50 acres on a point of land called Sipayik. It's at the very tip of that peninsula is an area called Split Rock. And this has long been held to be a sacred area where people can find peace of mind. It's a natural beach area where people can access the waters of Passamaquoddy Bay, launch their canoes, launch their boats. There's a horseshoe pit down there. It's a beautiful area. This terminal being proposed would obliterate that area, and it would put a major industrial facility right in the heart of our community. And there's already been talk of relocations, of moving the community back. As I said before, it's a very, very small community with a large population considering its size. You know, this facility is very large. Our community is very small. It's about a mile and a half across what they call the Western Passage over to Deer Island in New Brunswick. These ships require a wide berth and are escorted by armed gunboats, helicopters. There's exclusion zones all around the shipping lanes, exclusion zones all around the terminal, and it would severely disrupt our use and enjoyment of these waters and our own land.
You mentioned the suggestion of a relocation. I understand as well the community itself of Sipayik is a result of previous displacements of the Passamaquoddy people.
Yeah, after the Revolutionary War, the Loyalists, as they were called, occupied our main village, which was at Gwanasquamguk, and is now called St. Andrews. This was our main village. It's where our elders were buried. And, you know, as I said, the Loyalists, under English rule, displaced the native inhabitants of that area, which put them for a little while over on Deer Island and then eventually over to the American side.
David, why do you think Split Rock was chosen as one of the sites for an LNG terminal?
It was chosen out of desperation by those who fully support this proposal. The original proposal was at Gleason's Cove, which is actually on land that was purchased from the town of Perry in the mid-80s. There was a caveat with that purchase that any major industrial development would have to be approved by the voters of Perry. This is called Article 40. As soon as the community vote voted in favor of this terminal, the issue of Article 40 was raised, and the town of Perry was put to a vote on whether or not they approved this terminal. They turned down that proposal. They did not like the sound of a major industrial facility in their midst. And at that point, the developer just started looking around for another place, and out of desperation, they ended up at Split Rock. It's one of the only natural areas left in our small community. It's a common area. It's a green space. You know, as I said before, it has shorefront access. And, you know, they ended up there out of desperation. It's not the best place. It's not even a good place. It's what they had to do to make their dollars.
Tell us about and help us dispel some of the myths that the proponents of the LNG terminal advocate. You suggested promises of free gas and money and the like.
They'll pretty much tell you anything you want to hear to get their deal done. They've made a lot of promises. They're promising hundreds of jobs. Financial worries for the tribe will be virtually non-existent. They've made noise about jobs at the facility for tribal members, jobs in the construction process for tribal members. I suppose it's like any developer or any salesman that wants to sell you a product. They'll tell you what you want to hear. They'll make you any promise they want. You know, they've promised that Split Rock won't be disturbed and that access will be allowed. But, I mean, at any LNG facility, the public is not allowed. These are potentially dangerous facilities. So it's just a lot of noise that I'm hearing from them. It's promises that they can't keep or promises that they have no intention of keeping. It's just to get their process rolling that they'll pretty much say anything.
What are the impacts of the LNG terminal to the survival of the Passamaquoddy people, and in particular to Passamaquoddy ways of life?
Well, in the first place, it's a major industrial facility in our midst. And when I say in our midst, I'm talking about eighth of a mile, quarter mile, half a mile from several hundred homes, our health facilities, our schools, our places of worship. It's in our midst. And by their very nature, these are dangerous facilities. You know, anytime you store energy, it has the potential for catastrophic failure should everything go wrong. It's combustible by nature, and it's going to be smack dab in the middle of our community. So, I mean, if you just use a little bit of basic logic, you can see that the siting of this facility on Split Rock is the wrong place. These facilities should be sited in industrial areas, well away from homes, well away from places of business, schools, or anything like that.
Do you think that racism plays a role in choosing to locate these in Passamaquoddy community?
Well, I don't know if it's so much racism as it's preying on the economic desperation of the greater Washington County community. As you know, the employment rate in Washington County is down, sardine industry failed, industries are failing. So people are looking around for ways to maintain their economy. And, you know, when they see this coming down the pike with all these promises, and they're instantly interested in it because, you know, it could mean, you know, potential future economic good times. But the reality of it is that these terminals exclude other industries from the free use of the water, such as the fishing industry or the tourism industry, things like this. So, I mean, their argument that this is going to provide jobs and be a boon to the economy is false, because it's actually going to eliminate more jobs than it will create.
Since the announcement, what have been the responses from communities challenging the LNG project, including the involvement of your group?
Well, I can tell you the first thing that happened after that announcement was that many, many people from the community remained silent. Many elders and many young people have wished us all of their support and hope that we succeed in blocking this lease. We have the support of many community members, and that's why we do what we do. You know, we want to maintain our ancestral homeland and waters, as do they. The group that we put together, there's a core group of people who are very vocal and who are taking this all the way up to federal court to challenge this lease. We have the full backing of several hundred community members.
Can you explain, I guess, the approval process for the LNG facility, where it's at now, and bring us up to speed as to this court challenge that you just made reference to?
The Bureau of Indian Affairs approved this lease in a couple of weeks. It was a pretty rapid decision. And the processes that they should have gone through by looking at environmental impacts, by looking at community impacts, or even asking the question, is this even right for this community? This very, very small community. Those questions were never asked. They were urged at the council for the developer to approve this lease, to make it binding, and that's that. That's what they did. They waited 30 days after it was approved to announce it, because this is how long the period is to file for a grievance. They refused to share any information about how this lease approval was arrived at. I mean, they just rubber stamped it. And that's where our challenge goes back to. It's the process that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was supposed to follow. They're supposed to be a steward for Native people and not just there to rubber stamp tribal council decisions. But I can tell you that the BIA is being called to task on the processes that they took. When we argued this in lower court, they had one story. When we argued it in appeals court, they had another story. They're all over the place. They're saying that it had contingencies in lower court, and then in the higher court, the federal appeals court, they're saying that the lease is binding and was binding on the date that it was signed. So, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to see that they have no consistency about the decision that they made, which really reflects on the manner in which they approved it. They approved it rapidly, they approved it without forethought, and they did it at the urging of a developer.
Aside from this legal challenge, are there other strategies that you folks are pursuing to stop the development of the LNG terminal?
Just to maintain our cultural identity and to not back down in the face of the oil and gas industry. It's really our duty right now as tribal people to protect our homeland in any way that we can, to involve our children and our elders, and to continue to be good stewards of the land. As Passamaquoddy people, we were here then, we're here now, and we plan on being here in the future. Any industrial development that encroaches on our ancestral land, we're very concerned about. We're not opposed to economic growth. What we are opposed to is industries that are incongruous with our life ways and that bar us from our ancestral lands through exclusion zones and, you know, things of that nature. It's not in our nature among tribal people to close the door on our future generations just to enrich ourselves at the present. It's very important for us to maintain our ties to the land and the water and to do so for the future generations.
What other campaigns or what other activities is your group involved in?
Our group is involved mainly right now to protect our homeland. That's our top priority, and it's also, you know, we're right in the middle of it. We give our support to many other environmental justice campaigns, especially on indigenous lands, because this is not an isolated incident here in Maine. This is happening all over the United States. The Indigenous Environmental Network has kept us informed on the struggles that are going on with coal sands, oil sands. There are just many, many other issues involving water quality and exploitation of native lands by heavy industries, by the oil and gas industry, by the coal industry, and, you know, uranium mining, things of this nature. And our group will always support the traditional indigenous people who want to maintain their tribal land base. As you know, tribal land bases are very, 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 very diminished from colonial times. Process that just keeps happening, and it's happening now. It's happening again right in our midst. And it's our duty as tribal people to protect other tribal people and to not just go for the quick dollar. I think it takes more than money to build a strong community.
How can listeners support the Passamaquoddy struggle against the LNG facility?
Obviously, we have an ongoing legal struggle. This takes money. We ask for donations to Save Passamaquoddy Bay Canada, to our group, or to Save Passamaquoddy Bay USA. If you support us, be vocal about it. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Cast your support where you believe. Like I said, there's a lot of folks around the Bay of Fundy area in Passamaquoddy Bay that are going to be affected by this, and they should really take the time to understand exactly what's happening here and see how it's going to affect them down the road.
How can listeners get a hold of your group and or find out more information?
They can log on to our website, www.savepassamaquoddybay.org, and that will put you in touch with all of our groups.
David, thank you for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
You are listening to David Moses Bridges speaking with Pierre Loisel. A quick update on that piece. On September 14th, the United States Court of Appeal ruled in favor of We Take Care of Our Lands lawsuit against the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They overturned a ruling by the U.S. District Court in Maine that had dismissed the case. This lawsuit challenges the BIA's approval of the lease of Passamaquoddy Tribal Land to Quaddy Bay, LLC. And this victory gives the go-ahead for the trial to proceed.
And that's it for the show. If you'd like to know more about anything you heard today or more grassroots news from across the country and around the world, check out dominionpaper.ca. You've been listening to Dominion Radio on CKDU 88.1. You can hear us on the first Friday of every month from 5 until 6. I'm Hillary Lindsay.
And I'm Angela Day. thanks also to contributors and producers Stu Neepy and Pierre Lozelle, who helped put together tonight's show.